The well-known aphorism of George Santayana goes something like, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." It's been observed that those who do study history and remember the past are doomed to stand by and watch as everyone else repeats it. Among the troubling phenomena to which we are witness in this most difficult time of COVID-19 is the appearance of anti-Semitic attitudes and actions, harkening back to the medieval accusations of blood libels and well poisonings, and up to contemporary anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist rhetoric. Jews have often borne the blame of plagues which affected their host societies, even as they themselves were afflicted with bubonic plague or cholera or today's coronavirus in equal or sometimes even greater numbers. This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs with another episode of the Tradition Podcast. In light of these disturbing trends, and in the hopes that we might learn something about our current crisis from the study of history, I thought it would be informative to turn to my teacher, Professor David Berger, Dean of the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University. Dr. Berger has dedicated many decades of his academic career to the study of antisemitism. He's also a longtime member of Tradition's editorial board. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. David Berger.
Thank you.
So give us the historian's view, in short, of how this has played out throughout the ages. How does it occur that the general society looks to the Jew and blames the Jew when there are times of disease and plague and trauma?
Well, this is a phenomenon that exists against the backdrop of ongoing hostility. And it's not that the Jews are a minority group, and then all of a sudden, when something happens, they are blamed. Jews were seen, certainly in medieval Christendom, as not just an outside group, but rather as a group that was responsible for the killing of Jesus, that was being punished in an ongoing exile for this and related sins, so that when something happened, that some tragic event happened in society, it's not surprising that this group, which by the way was for the most part the only tolerated religious outsider group in medieval Christendom, so that the hostility towards such outsider groups was by nature focused on Jews. Mm-hmm. It's not surprising that they would have been blamed for this, particularly since there was no other known cause of the Black Death, for example. However, I really should say something more general. The issue is that in the so-called High Middle Ages, that is in the 12th and 13th centuries and into the 14th, there developed a hostility toward Jews for reasons that we can't go into now and which are to some degree speculative. That one historian in a very famous book called Chimerical Antisemitism, he defined that as accusations against Jews that affirm that Jews did things that no one ever saw a Jew do. This is not like the accusation of killing Jesus, which was based on some historical evidence. It was not even the accusation that Jews, let us say, curse Christians in their prayer, which was true, but rather that Jews kill Christian children in a ritual that their religion requires. The historian who coined this phrase, chimerical or imaginary anti-Semitism, was named Gavin Langmuir. His examples were well poisoning, having to do with the Black Death, the blood libel, that is, that Jews kill Christian children as part of a ritual requirement of Judaism, and host desecration, that you somehow get a hold of a consecrated piece of bread or wafer from the Catholic Mass, which was believed to be the body of Jesus, and desecrate it. These were his examples of anti-Semitism that he defined as accusations against Jews regarding things that no one ever saw a Jew do. Now, he even tried to define anti-Semitism itself in those terms, and that I think is a mistake. But the observation is worth making, and it tells us something about the absence of discipline in determining what accusations you will make. It's a case of hutra ritsua, so that you could say anything, and that is what made this possible and even likely. And there's one other point I'd like to make that I think is of analytical interest and even of a practical interest. Did people who made these accusations believe them? Did all of them believe them? Did some of them, at least the elite, make these accusations knowing that they were false? Now, the most recent study of the first blood libel or the first ritual murder accusation, there's a technical difference, in Norwich, England, has suggested in an innovative study that the first libel may really have resulted from a cold calculation in the context of a legal process where it was useful to make this accusation against Jews, so that the initial accusation may have been made with knowledge that it's not true. This is something that comes up again, for example, when the
presumably those that came up with the plot understood that it would have great currency amongst the masses.
Well, they wanted it to,
and in other words, they came up with a libel that would have been widely believed by the Christian masses.
There is no question that the vast majority of people who believed in the blood libel, resorted to the accusation, believed it. The masses certainly believed it. There is, in fact, one historian who suggested that one reason for expulsions of Jews was the belief on the part of the masses that these people who live among them have a religion that requires them to kidnap and murder their children. Anybody would be worried about that. Now, this is not the dominant explanation for the expulsions among historians, but it underscores the fact that the vast majority of people did certainly believe it. I was starting to mention that in the case of the Trent blood libel, one of the most famous ones, where Simon of Trent was made into a saint, one of the people who was pushing for his sainthood probably knew that the accusation was not true. So that we have here a combination in some cases anyway, of intentional concoction of falsehood, which then becomes enormously influential and believed by a vast majority of people. This is relevant, in my view, to the discussion of contemporary affairs, which we will get to at the time of your choosing.
Well, let's go there now. You have mentioned in your writing that you object in certain circumstances to the kind of sometimes knee-jerk reaction of Jewish political leaders, communal leaders, to cry blood libel every time there's an accusation made against the Jewish people or the state of Israel. Mentioned you feel that's inappropriate. I think you singled out Menachem Begin's use of the term during the Sabra and Shatila massacres, or in response to the criticism that Israel bore after that event in the 1980s. But nevertheless, you are quick to point out that there are contemporary iterations of blood libels, whether they involve a literal blood or more figuratively speaking. So tell us a little bit about your thinking about the contemporary use of these concepts.
Okay, so I do think that one has to be careful about using such a term, because first of all, it's wrong to use it when it's inappropriate, and it also undermines the force of its use when it is appropriate. There is no question in my mind that we are witnessing accusations against Jews, and particularly in the context of Israel, that do deserve to be compared to blood libels. And here, the issue that I mentioned a moment ago of whether the people who level these accusations believe them becomes, I think, particularly relevant. For example, do Palestinian leaders who say that Israel is responsible for the coronavirus believe that that is the case? I doubt it very much. Do they believe that Israel is harvesting the organs of Palestinians, an accusation that has been made and has gone beyond the initial circle? I doubt it very much. So some of this is a cynical use of this type of accusation, with the expectation that it could that it will be believed widely, and that has to be called out. It's not just to affirm that it's not true, but it's necessary, I think, to level criticisms against people who spread them, knowing that they are not true. Now, there are unfortunately not a few examples of this sort of thing. Sometimes these accusations are made against Jews as a group, and sometimes they are specifically made against Israel. And in those circumstances, I think it might be appropriate to use the term chimerical anti-Israelism. One example where I've used this term came right around the lead-in to the first Gulf War, when a few hundred academics, including Israeli academics, warned the world that Israel might take advantage of the fog of war to engage in ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. Now, you ask yourself, just in purely practical terms, what does it mean to say that Israel would take several hundred thousand residents of the West Bank and expel them? Now, they weren't talking, I don't think, about killing them, and expel them. And the world wouldn't notice because there's a war going on. I mean, this is a level of fantasy that I think deserves to be called chimerical.
By chimerical, you mean this kind of imagined bogeyman scenario where something nefarious is going on?
And something that has no roots whatsoever in reality, no connection to reality. Mm-hmm. Something that cannot be transformed into a plausible, realistic scenario. Other examples of this, I wrote about this briefly in an article that I sent you, is a book by a professor at Rutgers named Jasbir Puar called The Right to Maim, arguing that Israel, when it shoots at the legs of violent demonstrators, when lesser measures don't work, does so not in order to spare their lives by not killing them, but out of a policy of establishing a debilitated Palestinian population that could be exploited more readily. Now, I won't waste time discussing the absurdity of this, but not only do we find an academic writing this, this book received an award from the National Women's Studies Association in the United States.
And when the author was criticized, she was roundly defended by academics from very many quarters.
She was vigorously defended by, again, a few hundred academics. And since that award, she has received another award, not for this book specifically, from an academic entity in the City University Graduate Center, where Ba'av Amosai I taught for many years. So that we are confronted with affirmations of harvesting organs, of spreading a pandemic, and of a variety, for that matter, even of the classic blood libel, which has been revived in some of these circles, and in some cases, in one case, a Palestinian a person of some prominence utilized a much less popular version of the blood libel, saying that Jews use the blood for Hamantashen. This goes beyond its original use
for matzot.
Matzot and wine at the Seder. I say this almost with a kind of amused tone, but it's not, needless to say, it is very, very far from funny.
Indeed, indeed. Well, in other words, in the Middle Ages, no one understood how disease worked. No one understood how germs were spread. And in the search for a cause, in the search for a villain, the Jew, as you pointed out, who was the only target of an outsider, was quickly identified. Today we live in a world where the study of pandemics is wide known. Everybody walks around with the collected wisdom of civilization in their pocket, or at least access to it. We live in a scientific age. And yet, despite the fact that we understand where the disease comes from, even if we don't yet know how to obliterate it, we live in a world where, in certain quarters, perpetrators of these accusations know full well that there are true believers who will, hook, line, and sinker, take up these causes and make all types of accusations, or cynically use the opportunity of a worldwide pandemic and tragedy and trauma to blame the Jewish people. In the material that was recently published that you referred earlier, there's a cartoon in a Palestinian newspaper of the COVID molecule, which has become such an iconic symbol of everything that we've been going through this past month and a half, which has somehow transformed itself into the shape of the Star of David, of course. Nevertheless, and despite the fact that the Jewish people are suffering along with the rest of mankind, and in certain quarters, in even greater numbers, because certain parts of the Jewish community were slow in adopting the stay-at-home approach and the lockdown and became infected in even greater numbers, what do we have to learn from all of our historical study? What should we be cautious about now as we're still in the maze, still looking for the exit, not sure when we're going to get there? In the midst of this plague, what ought we do in order to protect ourselves against such vile accusations? And what should the appropriate response be?
Look, I wish that there were a clear answer to that question. There needs to be, at a minimum, an effort to clarify reality with effective, or as effective as possible, public statements and explanations. To do this right, from an intellectual perspective, you have to engage in a discourse that will not be accessible to masses of people. For example, you sent me just this morning a very fine article by Carrie Nelson, who wrote an entire book called Israel Denial, where there is a chapter, by the way, about Jasbir Puar. But the only people who will read that sort of thing and be influenced by it are people who knew before reading it that these accusations are not true.
Yes. The choir being preached to.
Yes, what is needed, and I don't pretend that I think that this will be fully effective, an effort on the part of people who have expertise in using social media and written materials that reach large audiences to expose these affirmations, not merely as falsehoods, but, and this is what brings me back to what I said before and why I said it, but as falsehoods that are being spread by people who know that they are falsehoods. And in that way, perhaps, to succeed in discrediting these accusations by discrediting the accusers. Mm-hmm. I don't pretend to think that this will be fully effective, but this is a case of not being obligated to finish the job, but not being permitted to desist from it.
Well, we hope our listeners and readers of Tradition will take up that call and help participate in spreading truth. We should also say, I believe, that insofar as the Jewish community has an obligation to sanctify God's name, to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim, and certainly avoid the opposite, as well as, you know, the paramount obligation of protecting and preserving life, we have to be vigilant in all corners of the Jewish world of not doing things which look like they are flouting the guidelines, some of which, you know, we've seen gatherings of weddings and participating in a minyan where that has been countermanded by the guidelines, because in fact, beyond the very real danger to life, it puts fuel on the fire and it shows, see, that's what the Jews are doing. They're helping to spread this disease. These were not things that could have been said in the Middle Ages around the plague or in times of cholera, but today I think they are being said, and they are not completely without cause, even if they are absolutely not legitimate excuses for the vile antisemitism that we do sometimes see.
But we should keep in mind, although it's certainly true that people should not do dangerous things, and especially if they are evident to the world, that the accusations being made against the Jewish community regarding this matter generally don't focus on the violation of guidelines. Certainly, they do in some quarters, and you know, locally, and some of those local accusations are entirely defensible. But the nature of the accusations in the broad sense involve Jewish responsibility either for spreading the virus from the outset,
yeah, no.
or using it in order to attain
to target
domination, because Israel will then, after starting this or disseminating it, will then come up with a vaccine. Yeah. And the world will be dependent on Israel, and Israel will be able to dominate the world, which is the reason for all of this. This sort of thing is not really connected with improper large funerals.
No, clearly, and I was not meaning to imply such, but it is true that we ought to do everything that we can in order not to beyond the obligation of protecting and preserving life, to create ourselves as targets of such accusations. And I have seen on social media from non-Jewish websites or Facebook posts pointing to, you know, weddings in a particular case, a wedding in a well-known ultra-Orthodox community, against all the guidelines, and attached to it was this accusation of an anti-Semitic attitude, you know, and pointing to it as an example of the misdeeds of the Jewish people. But that's a secondary point, as you correctly point out. Well, we wish you and all of our listeners and readers continued good health. Some of Dr. Berger's writings on these topics and others were most recently collected in his volume of essays, Persecution, Polemic, and Dialogue, Essays in Jewish-Christian Relations, published by the Academic Studies Press. And we commend it to your attention to read more of Dr. David Berger's thinking on these matters and other points of scholarship in Jewish-Christian relations. And we suggest to our listeners to please visit us on traditiononline.org to sample some of the content we've been putting there between the appearance of each of our quarterly print issues, and to visit us on the Facebook page of Tradition Journal and give us a like to keep updated with everything that's happening in our Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought. Thank you, David Berger.
Thank you.